Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming back and joining me this week on Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and welcome to Masters Week, my favorite week of the year. Nothing outside of Christmas feels as magical as this week does. From the tradition like no other, to Magnolia Lane, to the $1.50 egg salad and pimento cheese sandwiches, to the perfectly manicured fairways where weeds don't dare grow, to the back nine roars, and the green jacket. It just doesn't get any better than this. And to that end, we're going to be talking all Masters all the time this week on the show. We're going to go Masters past with some great players that have actually played in multiple Masters, and we'll get their present thoughts on the guys out there playing this week and who they may like to be donning the green jacket come this Sunday evening. We're going to do it with four great friends of the show. And leading off is going to be our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, a long overdue return visit to the show. He'll be followed by a 21-time winner between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour, and that's John Cook. Leading off part two of this week's show is going to be 1989 Open champion Mark Calcavecchia, who is actually over at Augusta National this week, staying in Augusta, out there intermingling with the patrons, walking the grounds, enjoying all the sights and sounds, and the merchandise tent over there. A lot of great stories with Mark. He'll be back on leading off part two. And then we'll round it out with one of the great instructors in the game and my Goomba, Rob Strano. So like I say, we're going to get a lot of Masters talk, a lot of really great stories, and we're going to have a lot of fun this week here on the show. And as always, thank you all so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me this week. Before we get into all of that, and as I've been saying to you guys all season long, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint, and they have done some magical things with our logos and created some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, @CTMascaro. Check them out there so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You gotta see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to Macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, finally back with us after a very long hiatus is our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. TP is out there, as you guys know, improving swings and short games for the folks at Twin Eagles Club in Naples, Florida. He's a 13-time Golf Magazine Top 100 teacher, a 4-time PGA Teacher of the Year, 3-time Golf Digest Best in the State, including this year and that edition. And he is back, and I couldn't be more excited with me here this week on Next on the Tee. Good evening, TP. How are you, my friend?
Oh, Christian boy!
I missed that. TP, where have you been?
I am laying on a bed in a guest room in Sea Island, Georgia, overlooking the marsh. Just got done hitting a few balls at Ocean Forest, heading out to dinner with some friends, and life is good, Chrissy. Life is good.
Ah, good for you, TP. So happy Masters Week, by the way, my friend.
Chris, your favorite and my favorite week of the year, I think. I think I can speak for you on that one. Can I not?
Absolutely, you can. You kidding me? Oh. I'm tickle me pink and various other colors. Azalea colors, for that matter.
Yeah, so we Denise and I typically come here to Sea Island to some friends that have a house here at Sea Island, Masters Week, or split the week between Augusta and here. And this year it's all Sea Island because we, as you know, we have a new puppy and he's not ready to be left alone yet. So we had to kind of do some. We had a really, you know, kind of rough here at Sea Island for the week.
You poor thing.
Yeah, I know exactly.
So, Tom, I was looking back at a lot of Masters history, looking forward to this week's show. And really, I was checking out some of the par three contest winners. And I know you're friends with the Harmon family, particularly Bill Harmon and his father, Claude, obviously won the 1948 Masters. 20 years later, in 68, I saw at the age of 51, he made back-to-back aces during the par three contest on the fourth and fifth holes. Yeah, an amazing feat to do that, not only twice in 9 holes, but on back-to-back holes. But did you ever talk to the Harmon boys about their father and him winning the Masters and all the time that he spent there at Augusta National?
Actually, I've talked to Billy about it, Chris. On one occasion, I had some conversation with Billy about Dad, and you know, all the boys. And I've heard the boys speak about him at seminars and at speaking engagements. Billy and I spoke in person about him. They revered their dad. He was a tough taskmaster. I met Mr. Harmon one time before he passed, for a brief second. He was a very imposing figure, you know, just one of those guys that, you know, kind of filled up the room. But the boys loved their dad, you know, and revered him, and respected him tremendously. And obviously he obviously did pretty good because he put out four great products and Dickie, Billy Craig, and Butchie. So that's a hell of a legacy to leave behind, those four guys. They're all tremendous at what they do. And what people don't realize about the four of them, they're all four of them are very fine players too.
Tom, we all know about the curse of winning the par three contest. I'm curious, do you believe in superstition? If you were a guy that was going to be playing in a Masters tournament and you went out there to play in the par three, would you try to win it to get the trophy, or if you happen to be in or around the lead of the tournament, well, going to the ninth tee, you dumping a few in the water?
If I was that fine of a player, and you know, we're both Italian in heritage, and I got to number 9 and I was 5 or 6 under, you can bet I'd be ponding one of those babies. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Yeah, I always get a chuckle when some guy's leading and he gets it on the ninth tee or even on the ninth green, and then all of a sudden he accidentally puts one into the water. Like, really? I wonder how that happened.
Oh, guess what? I'd be right behind him at the life preserver, pal. I'm in there too.
With you. I also know you were one of the couple dozen people who were there when Gene Sarazen made the shot heard around the world for double eagle on 15 in 1935. Is that your favorite Masters memory? Maybe do you have another one?
Oh, you know, I got to tell you my Gene Sarazen story. I think we've talked about this, Chris, but I became really good friends during my Westchester years with Ken Venturi, because when we had the Buick Classic at Westchester, Ken would come and obviously do the tournament for CBS with Mr. Nance, and Kenny and I became really friendly, and Kenny invited me the first time, long before I lived in Naples, Kenny invited me to Naples / Marco Island to spend a day, play golf, and hang out and just talk golf. And I showed up to meet him at his club, and we were going to have lunch in the men's locker room before we played. And he said to me, I invited a friend along. I hope you don't mind. And the door opened up literally, and in walks Gene Sarazen, knickers, shirt and tie, jacket. And I almost fell off my chair, obviously. And he didn't play with us, but he rode around. We had lunch and we talked, and he rode around with us because he was kind of past his playing time. But it was awesome. And yeah, I was there. I was there when he made that too. Chris, you're absolutely right. I was right there as one of the few people in the gallery at that point. I turned 175 this year, so you know I was there. But my favorite Masters moment, basically because I'm prejudiced and it's a friend, was when Freddie parked it on the bank on number 12 and then got up and down and made three and then went on to win. So that's my favorite Masters moment. But there's so many great ones, and that's just because he's a buddy. But you know, every year, you know, we wait for the back nine on Sunday, Chris, and something crazy happens. I mean, whether it's what Spieth did on 12, Molinari did on 12, you know, the shot Phil hit out of the pine straw on 13, you know, something crazy always seems to happen on the back nine on Sunday. You just know something's going to happen. It's just not going to be smooth sailing all the way. And this year will be no different, I'm sure.
So let's go back to what you said a moment ago and Freddie winning and the shot on 12, because him winning that tournament had to be ordained by God, because I mean, that ball doesn't come anywhere near getting on the green. How it doesn't bound off the bank of that green and bounce into Rays Creek or at a minimum hit the bank and roll back into Rays Creek is just, it's mind boggling. Did he ever tell you about that shot and talk about how in the world the grass seemed to hold that ball up when it's never done that?
Well, you know, when I pressed on the story, he just kind of, and you got to know Freddie to appreciate this, he just starts laughing and shrugs his shoulders like, dude, you think I have an answer? Because you don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. You know, Jesus Christ have an answer to that one. That doesn't make any gravity. He defied gravity there, right? I mean, at that ball, if you hit 1,000 shots into that position, 999 would go in the water, you know? But when you're supposed to win, when it's your time, those things seem to happen, don't they? And it was his time. It was just his time.
Tom, you've walked that course several times, as have I. And, you know, I think there's a lot of things about that golf course that people who have never been fortunate enough to get out on that property just can't appreciate. Television doesn't do it justice. We talk about it all the time, the elevation changes. And I'm not sure, Tom, that there is a level lie anywhere on that golf course besides on the tee boxes. Talk about what people don't get an appreciation for by watching it on TV.
You know, Chris, that's a great point. I mean, I remember the first time I went, I went to see Fred. Fred invited me to come down and spend some time with him. And I got to the property kind of late. He was, you know, I had to track him down because I was getting in the gate late. And I walked around as you would, as every patron would. I walked kind of past the merchandise area, kind of around the corner of the clubhouse. And I remember the first time I turned the corner there and saw the vista that is, you know, that lays out in front of you. People have no idea, like you said, of the elevation change and the aura of that property. I mean, it takes your breath away the first time you television does not do it justice. And whenever I take people, you know, when I've been fortunate to take some corporate groups and do some things there over the years at tournaments, I always get him in the gate early. And the first thing I do, Chris, is at 7:30 when you run in the gate early, is I take him to the 10th tee and I make him walk the back nine at 7:30 when there are very few guys on the back nine. Just walk the back nine without any people on it. Because when you can see those holes unobstructed and without any view, you know, without any people in front of you, it really does take your breath away. It gives you a real appreciation for the piece of property. And then I bring them back up 18. But, you know, you can walk the back nine in 45 minutes if you're moving around there pretty quickly. But it gives you a real appreciation for the property. It is the most beautiful piece of property that you've ever seen. And the elevation changes are just incredible. When you get down all the way to what is kind of 12T, and you really think about where the clubhouse is, how far above you the clubhouse actually is at that point, you realize that it is not an easy walk, really. It's a really well banked piece of property. And like you said, because of that, there is not a level lie on that property.
Yeah, I think to give everybody a visual, I saw this visually on one of the magazines did a thing on the elevation changes. And from the 10th tee down to the 10th green, the elevation change from those two points is as tall as the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
That's unbelievable to think. Top of the property down to the bottom piece of the property. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And then, as you know, 11 goes down even further and 12 goes down further. So it's a real, and then you kind of bottom out at 12 and you start gradually working your way back up on 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18. And how about the walk up 18? How about the tee shot on 18? I mean, you're hitting it out of a thimble, just straight up a hill, and you got to hit that ball. I mean, you know, I hate to burst both of our bubbles, but if I stood on the back tee on 18, I don't think I could hit. I don't think I could reach the fairway. you got to carry the ball 275 or 280 or 290 minimum to get the ball, you know, up into what is some kind of reasonable area and hit a second shot to that green.
Right. Yeah. And you got to
hit it on a string, on an absolute string. It's an incredible piece of property. Just awesome.
Yeah. And just to take that a half a step further, standing on that back tee on 18, it's like you got to hit it out of a chute. I mean, those trees on the left come into play. We saw Jordan Spieth when he had an opportunity a couple of years ago coming down the stretch to possibly get into a playoff, hit a branch on the left trees and bounce it into the trees. The right-hand side is a bunch of trees and bushes. It's an intimidating tee shot just to get it going.
There's no wiggle room right there at all. Not at all, really.
Right.
I mean, and even like the tee shot off the very back tee on 11 is no bargain either. I mean, there's several tee shots there where the ball cannot curve. You have to just hit the ball middle of the club face online, or you don't have an option.
If you were to get in there in the morning as a patron and have your chairs, and one of the great things about Augusta National is you can go in there, put your chair down, and no one's going to touch it all day long, even if you're not sitting in it. But do you have a favorite hole? Are you going to plant yourself somewhere on Sunday to watch all the guys come through? Do you have a favorite place that you'd want to be?
You know, because I'm not a sitting, you know me well enough, though, I'm not a still guy, so I'm not a guy who's going to plant a chair. If I was going to plant a chair, probably be, you know, I actually like the stands they've built to the left of 16T, because you can watch from those stands on the left of 16T, you can see the second shot on 15, you can see the shot on 16, and you can at least see the swings off of 17T from there. So I kind of like that spot a lot. There's a stand now behind the fourth tee, which is a great par three hole, and from that stand you can see the drive and the second shot on three and the tee shot on four. So there's a lot of great viewing spots out there, but I'm more of a guy that's going to walk, you know, find a group and walk, or walk between two or three groups back and forth and keep moving.
One of the unique things about Augusta National is the fact that there's no rough. It's a second shot golf course, but even at that, you have to know where on the green to hit it, because as some players have said to me, a 10 footer in the wrong spot is worse than a 25 or 30 footer in the right spot. Have you seen other courses like that, particularly greens like this? And have guys made that same comment to you?
No, I'll tell you a story. You know, back to Kenny Venturi. Kenny Venturi, the first time I told him I was going to be going to Augusta for the first time the following spring, and we're talking about the greens and the green complexes, he said to me, "I can put you, Tom, on every green on Augusta in regulation if you let me place the ball somewhere on a green, depending where the pin. If you let me place your ball on the green, on every green in regulation, you would not break 90.
Wow. I said,
"Kenny, come on." He goes, "If you let me put the ball at some place on every green, considering that you're on the green in regulation, and I give you a starting point with a starting putt, you will not break 90.
Wow.
And as he was telling me, he didn't think there were certain places that I could two putt even one time out of 18 times given the opportunity. And I found that hard to believe until I went there for the first time by myself. And again, the first time I went there to see Fred, and I got an up close look at number one. And I mean, when I said up close look, I was fortunate enough, and I can't even tell you why this happened, but I was inside the ropes for a little while, and I stood on the first screen with Joey and Fred. And I looked at Joey, I said, where's the easy pin placement? He goes, there is no easy pin placement, TP. There's not one. The first screen, when you stand on it and you actually stand there and look around, it is absolutely scary as crap. I mean, you realize you're on the first screen, you got 17 more of these to go. Good luck, pal. Strap on. People do not understand how talented these people are when they hole putts on those greens in those conditions under that pressure. They don't understand.
There were a lot of great legends that never won the Masters. Is there someone you always wanted to see win it, but unfortunately he never got it done?
He's still out there and he's still trying. His name is Ricky Fowler for me. I just think it would change his whole legacy. It would be good for golf. It'd be a great feel good story. That's kind of one for me, but a man that I was very close to, that's, you know, people out there listening will have to look up this one because it's probably not a familiar name, but I had a man on my staff at Westchester named Harry Lighthorse Cooper, who finished second in the U.S. Open. He finished second at the Masters and was runner up at the PGA one year, played most of his golf in the 40s and 50s, had a hell of a career. I think he won 40 events. On what was the early tour. It wasn't the PGA tour, that was just the early tour. But Harry Lighthorse Cooper lost by a shot. If I'm correct, you can check me on this, Chris. I believe he was run up to Horton Smith. Was snake bit there. Lost to, trying to think who he lost to at Baltusrol in the US Open. Tony Monero, I think. How's that? Pulling that one out of my hat.
Wow.
At Baltusrol. But Harry had a great career, and he was part of my staff at Westchester. We buried him when he was, I think, 93. A great historical figure in the PGA Golf Hall of Fame, by the way. So I guess Harry Cooper from the old school and Ricky Fowler from the new school were my two picks.
Were you surprised at all by the timing of JT and Bones kind of going their separate ways? I thought it was kind of odd to see something like that happen right before the Masters.
Two things that don't make any sense to me, Chris, today, and we were just talking about it, you know, some friends we're visiting right now because they're asking me some questions. JT and Bones split up, and the timing of that makes absolutely no sense. And, you know, we'll never hear the inside story and those kind of things. Something happened, obviously, there, because it makes absolutely zero sense to do that right now, especially with the guy in your bag who has had a winning bag on several occasions and one of the really good caddies on the PGA Tour, all-time great caddies. And then the other thing that makes no sense to me is, let's go back about 10 months ago. How was Victor Hovland playing 10 months ago? Might have been the best player in the world. And no offense to Scottie Scheffler, but he was having an incredible run, capped off at a great Ryder Cup. And then he decided to change swing coaches, and has changed them three times in the last 150 days. What the hell is he thinking? And can't find the club face right now. So, you know, what people don't realize, you know, my members do kind of goofy things sometimes when you're working with them on the lesson tee, and these tour players do things that are just as goofy sometimes. And you explain, if you can explain JT and Bones to me, and you can explain Victor Hovland to me, you can give me some answers. I surely don't understand or know the answers to.
Yeah, let's talk about something else that was a head scratcher to me, because speaking of changes, both Scottie Scheffler and Brooks Koepka have recently made switches to mallet putter. Scotty going to a TaylorMade Spider putter, and Brooks with a Scotty Cameron Phantom X5.5. That seems like another odd thing to be doing, changing a putter, either for Brooks right up to when you're playing in the Masters, and Scotty just a couple of weeks ago, especially as you were mentioning a little bit ago, trying to navigate the greens is hard enough. Trying to navigate it with a new putter seems like almost impossible.
Chris, the other side of that is we've seen a lot of players, a gross amount of players, go from a blade to a putter in the last probably 24 months, 36 months. You can check me on this, but I think it's a very high percentage of mallet putters on the tour right now. I had putted with a blade my whole life and went to a mallet about 2.5 years ago. And I putted with the same putter from the time I was 11 years old to 2.5 years ago and switched to a mallet and found it incredibly more easy to aim. More balls started online. I've always been a pretty good putter, but it made my life a lot easier. Hey, listen, if you're putting bad, I mean really bad, Scotty was putting awful. He's gone on a hell of a run since he made the switch. I didn't know about Brooks until you just told me. At least Scotty did it 3 or 4 weeks ago, you know, before a major, but did it before TPC too, not too long before TPC. I didn't know about Brooks, but I don't think Brooks is one of the brightest human beings on the planet anyway, so it doesn't surprise me one bit.
Wow.
Ouch. Ouch.
Indeed. Sticking with Scotty, if Scotty were to go on and win this week, be his second Masters in 3 years, he became the first player to win back-to-back Players Championships, it'd be his 9th win. Is it time to start thinking of him in the same way that we did with Tiger back in 97, 98? I mean, what it would feel like to me is that Ben Hogan handed the baton to Jack, Jack handed it to Tiger, and it would almost feel like Tiger is now handing it to Scotty if he were to get a win either at the Masters or one of the other majors this year.
You know, you can certainly, you know, crown, if he wins the Masters, you can crown him the best player in the world by a long stretch if he does that this week. But, Chris, for me, somebody, whether it's Scotty or somebody we haven't even heard of yet, has to come along and do some things much more incredible than that, be mentioned in the same breath as Tiger Woods. I mean, the things that he's done in the last, you know, 20 years of golf, the record, the tour wins record, the majors, the shots he's hit, the clutch shots he's hit in key moments, the putts he's held, the incredible escape artist that he's been. I don't put anybody in the same breath with Tiger right now. And you and I aren't the biggest Tiger fans in the world. We both talk about that a lot off air, but you got to give him all the respect in the world for what he's accomplished. And Scotty's on a hell of a run. Don't get me wrong, but he's not Tiger Woods.
So one more before I let you go. So I got to get a winner from you. I know you said a little bit ago, you're rooting for Ricky Fowler. If it's not Ricky, who are you pulling for?
You know, I've been asked that question, Chris, 25 times this week by members and friends. I was asked it tonight at dinner. I'm not at dinner, just when I arrived here at this people's house that I'm staying with. For the first time in a long time at this event, I can't pick a clear favorite. I for some reason, I just don't see Scotty doing it this week, and I don't know why I'm saying that. I have no reason to say that. All the obvious names are there, right? I mean, Brooks and Rahm and Scotty, JT doesn't seem to be playing very well in the caddy controversy, so you kind of put him on the back burner right now. Hovland, 9 months ago, I would have been a clear favorite, but he's upside down right now. I see Xander's playing pretty well. You know, I think Hideki has played very, very well recently, very quietly played very well. I mean, he had a great win at LA and he's played well since then. There's so much, as I always say to you, there's so much talent out there and so many goofy things happen on the back nine on Sunday. I don't have a clear favorite for you. I really don't.
Wow. Okay. Well, Tom, who's mine?
Yeah.
I was all on the Brooks Koepka train until I read about the putter switch, and I thought this is not the time to do that. So I've jumped off that bandwagon a little bit. But I tell you what, you mentioned Hideki Matsuyama, guy obviously that won it a few years ago and won earlier this season. I like the way he's playing too. I wouldn't put it past him to be a guy that's on the top of the leaderboard come late Sunday afternoon.
And my dark horse is always going to be Chris Mascaro.
As it should be. Tom, before I let you go, remind everybody how they can get up to date with you, whether it's on social media, your website, or YouTube.
Chris, all the obvious places, LinkedIn, LinkedIn, and Instagram, Facebook. And then the website is just tompatry.com. But better find me here on Tuesday night. And I apologize for my absenteeness. In the last couple of weeks, I was slammed at work, both AM and PM with some member activities. But I'm back now strong where I'm supposed to be with the M-Man.
There you go. TP, enjoy the week, my friend. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up again soon.
Hey, Chris, tell Calkin Cook I said hi.
I will absolutely do that.
Thanks, pal.
See you, Tom.
Bye, buddy.
That is the great Tom Patry, folks. They don't come better than that guy. Again, TomPatry.com is the website. Go out on his YouTube channel. Subscribe there. You can get over 300 free video lessons from Tom out there. And you can follow him on Instagram at TomPatryGolf. Just one of my favorite people on the planet. So I missed him. 5 weeks without Tom on the show. So it's good that we're going to get back on track with him. He'll be back on the show 2 weeks from tonight. Okay, coming up next with me is going to be a guy who won 21 times between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour, and somebody who's become very special to me, one of my all-time favorites here on the show, and that is John Cook. Before I get to Cookie, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout-out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf, and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an on-point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lambkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black Grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lambkin. Feel is everything. All right, and speaking about back with me is now John Cook. John is a 21-time winner between the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. Let me remind you a little bit more about his background. He's from Toledo, Ohio, but grew up in Southern California. He went back and played his college golf at Ohio State, where he was a three-time All-American. He helped them win three consecutive Big Ten titles from 1977 to 1979 and the 1979 National Championship. John won six individual titles while he was there at Ohio State. He also won the Les Bostead Award for the lowest stroke average in the conference each year from 77 to 79. He was inducted into the Ohio State Hall of Fame in 1986. He won the U.S. Amateur Championship in 1978 and finished second to Marco Mira in 79. He won several amateur championships during his time out there in California, including the California State Am in 75 and then back in Ohio at the Ohio Am in 78 and 79. He would turn pro later in 1979, and he got his first PGA Tour victory at the 1981 Bing Crosby National Pro-Am. He won again in 1983 at the Canadian Open, beating Johnny Miller in a playoff. John has 7 top 10 finishes in majors. He was named the 1992 PGA Tour Comeback Player of the Year. And in 2013, he was inducted into the Southern California Golf Association's Hall of Fame. And I couldn't be more excited. He is back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Cookie, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, Chris. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
So welcome to Masters Week. And I got to ask you, in the golf season, where does this week rank for you?
You know, it's really interesting. It's a very, very special week, obviously, but probably for not the reason that you were thinking. My our middle daughter was born during Masters Week in 1984. And I actually missed her birth because...
So yeah. I'm sorry, pick it up from where you left off. You got your middle daughter was born?
Yeah, Courtney was born on April the 11th in 1984. I actually had left and arrived in Augusta that morning to play the Masters because we thought, you know, I was home for the 2 weeks prior, and she never arrived. So we thought, well, there must have been a miscalculation or something. Jan was feeling fine, but just no baby on the way. So I left that afternoon and then arrived the next morning to play a practice round and then get ready to play on Thursday. And sure enough, it, you know, I'm hitting balls on the range, on the practice area, on Wednesday morning, and got the news that Courtney Catherine Cook was born that morning. So
wow.
It was a very special week. I always loved the Masters, Chris. It never loved me back for some reason. I had a bad record around there. I was always really prepared and playing well going into Augusta week. And maybe I just over-prepared and over-practiced myself. And by the time I got to Thursday or Friday or to the weekend, I was pretty much spent. I don't know what it was. I loved it so much, everything about it. From the first time I stepped on the ground with Ken Venturi, in 1979 as an amateur, I knew I was going to fall in love with Augusta National.
Do you remember the first time that you and Mr. Venturi drove up Magnolia Lane?
Yeah, I drove up. I got in on Sunday and stayed one night in the Crow's Nest with Bobby Clampett before my family was arriving in Augusta. We had rented a house. So I actually was there, you know, that evening, on that Sunday evening. And then when I went to the golf course on Monday to join Ken and Tom Weisskopf and Ed Snead for a practice round Monday, that's when I drove up, you know, and really got to soak it all in. And then just walking, you know, 54 holes with Kenny and Tom Weisskopf and Ed Snead for the next 3 days was, you know, I was just soaking it all in, to be honest. I couldn't, I was a sponge. I never said a word in 3 days. All I did was listen. And it was really, really a special walk around Augusta National with, you know, those three greats.
You made the cut that first time around, which to me seems like a heck of an accomplishment for a guy who had never played the course going into that 79 Masters. To actually go through as an amateur and make the cut seems like a hefty achievement.
Yeah, it was something. I didn't know what to expect. I was very prepared to play. Obviously, I'd spent the week before at Mission Hills Country Club, where my parents had a place. I was there all week. It was during the Dinah Shore week, actually, and I played a couple days in the Pro-Am, and then I got ready there at Mission Hills, just off by myself, just practicing at the end of the range, not trying to get in any of the, you know, the LPGA Tour players' ways. And, you know, so I got some great preparation done. And then when I, you know, got to Augusta and played those three practice rounds, boy, I was ready to go. So my first tournament round was with the defending champion, Gary Player. And I shot 71 and felt comfortable all day. I knew Mr. Player from playing a lot of amateur golf with his son, Wayne. So, you know, we had a nice walk around and I enjoyed it. And from then on, I loved it so much like I said, Augusta didn't really love me back.
John, over the course of your playing career, I believe you played out there 15 times. Did you collect any great Augusta National memorabilia or things along the way to kind of preserve the memory of being able to actually be a part of that tournament?
Oh, yeah. I got some crystal. I got some eagle crystal. I got low round a couple of times, low round crystal. I actually led after two rounds. I led after one round in 87 and then was tied for the lead after two rounds in 87 with Larry Mize, the year that he won. So I got some crystal and it's proudly displayed here in the cookhouse. So it's, like I said, it's a very, very special week and I wish I had a better record. Honestly, I either missed the cut by a shot or I, you know, played on the weekend and didn't fare very well. Usually that 11th hole was mostly to my demise, on Sundays. I think I made a couple of sevens there when I was, you know, in the top 10 or near the lead. So that hole always gave me the shivers when I got on that tee.
Talk about how tricky the 11th hole is, because I'm sure you're not the only one that had a tough time coming down and trying to get on that green.
Yeah, you know, I it was interesting. I always drove it well, and I always thought I had the right shot shape to, you know, hit it into any of those hole locations. And the times that I made big numbers, you know, I had the golf ball kind of, I was swung it across the slope and it would end up, you know, just getting into the hazard, the yellow hazard. And I promise you that drop area was no bargain. That drop area was sandy. The cut was a little bit longer than the fairway. And when you dropped it, I mean, you knew that you had your hands, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. It wasn't any easier from 50 yards over that water or from 200 yards with a four or five iron down that hill. So it was, it was pretty scary. So that number 11 got me.
I always have heard about 12 and trying to figure out the wind when you're standing on that tee, it swirls back there. It comes, the flag may be going in one direction, but the wind at the higher levels may be going some other direction. How did you try to navigate what you needed to hit on 12?
So basically, when I played my first practice round there, Kenny and Tom Weisskopf, basically said, just, kind of where the wind direction is. But when you're about ready to hit, make sure that you look over at the 11th green and see where that flag is blowing. So I always had a good number right over the middle of that bunker. Didn't matter what tee it was the left tee or the right tee. I had the same aiming spot every single time, and that was over that little tongue in that front bunker, and another yard or two there, and just that's where I was looking. And if I got in the bunker, hey, that was fine. I think I only hit it in Ray's Creek maybe once or twice. I did hit it up on that back hill one time. I remember playing with Ben Crenshaw one day. I think it was a Sunday, and he kind of got a six iron up in the air, and it never came close to clearing the creek. And I went, well, if he got six iron up in the air, he's a lot stronger than me. Well, maybe I'll try to I might try to flight a five iron. I mean, the wind was really ripping. That's how hard the wind was blowing. And sure enough, the wind stopped like right in midair, and my ball, it might still be on that on Augusta Country Club back there behind that fence. It was way up in the pine straw in those trees back there.
I'm guessing when you went through all those practice rounds with those guys, they were telling you to aim over that bunker, because John, I'm always amazed, and I've talked about it on this show many times, of how guys get sucked in on Sunday to try to aim to that right pin placement. And 9 times out of 10, when they do that, the ball ends up going back into Ray's Creek. The shot is always, to your point, no matter where the tee is, always over that bunker. Did those guys warn you about, yeah, it's going to look very inviting to get to that right pin placement, but don't do it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, back in those days, it was, and every once in a while, it might have been a 6-iron shot, but it was mostly a 7-iron shot. So, it was a little over 150 over that bunker. And Kenny, he would always say, hey,
take a look at that flag stick. There's nothing wrong with looking at that flag stick, but don't make that your last look. Your last look needs to be right where that target is, and that's right over the middle of that bunker. So I had some pretty good success with that right pin. I had some pretty good success over there just by taking it 25, 30 feet left of the hole, or even just off the back of the green. So it, that was a great aiming spot, and you know, just great knowledge from Tom and Kenny.
John, I was talking to Tom Petry in the first segment here about Scottie Scheffler and the great run that he has been on over the last couple of years. If he were to go on to win this week, it'd be a second Masters victory in 3 years. We just saw him win back-to-back Players Championships, the first guy to ever do that. It would be his ninth victory. I kind of feel like we need to start giving him his due, and I kind of look at a historical timeline where I feel like, you know, Ben Hogan handed the baton to Jack Nicklaus. Jack handed it to Tiger. It almost might feel like it's time that Tiger is going to hand it to Scotty. What are your thoughts if he puts on a second green jacket?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I totally understand the timeline and you know, kind of the passing. Scotty's got to show more. I mean, he's showing a lot, and he is by far the number one right now. As far as every category, just about it, he is, you know, Tiger in those days. And remember, though, Tiger did it for 10 straight years. And Scotty's on his, you know, second year of, you know, this type of domination, third year on, you know, winning a lot of championships. I will give Scotty his due on what he's done so far. I pumped the brakes a little bit on, you know, anointing him the next Tiger Woods, because there just won't be one. It's not going to happen. Not in my lifetime, you know, maybe in some other lifetime. And that I witnessed it. I saw it. Not only did he pass the smell test, the eye test, the sound test, I mean, everything. But he did it for 10 straight years. And that's something that nobody ever did.
John, I want to switch gears and talk about where we are in our game right now, because viewership overall for the PGA Tour is down about 20%. And I think it's partially due to fan fatigue over all the issues around the PIF and the PGA Tour and the infighting and when are the two groups going to come together and all of those sorts of things. I also think the fringe fans who Tiger brought into our game have started to tune back out since he rarely plays. It feels like our game is in a great place overall from a participation standpoint, but it feels like we need a sense of urgency to get all of the other internal things solved so people want to come back to the game again and people quit tuning out. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, Chris. And yeah, I think your viewership has been down. I don't think the show ponies have really shown yet. When you have Rory in the mix every single week, or you have, you know, those, you know, Jordan in the mix every single week, JT in the mix every single week, Ricky in the mix every single week. Those are the names that are left on the PGA Tour. And of course, they're developing some incredible young talent. And that incredible young talent is starting to show a little bit. And they're not afraid of these guys. I do think that, you know, some of these signature events have kind of watered down, some of those, you know, those stories, but the show ponies that are, you know, been voted in, that all this signature event stuff, they're not taking advantage of it. And, you know, those guys need to start showing more. Scotty certainly is doing what he's supposed to be doing. But is he really like that fringe viewer needle mover? Maybe not. And that's not a knock on Scotty. He is an incredible talent and a great, great, great young man. But you know, a lot of those names that the viewers were very familiar with are no longer there, and they can only play in certain events. And at some point in time, I think there's going to have to be some sort of an agreement or a handshake or something that's going to get these players to compete more often together. Not all the time. It's not a free welcome back. That is not what I'm saying. But I think that there needs to be some sort of, a transition, you know, into some other events other than the four majors, because they can't play the Players. So that's, you know, it's just, I think, a combination of things. The new young stories are starting to emerge. The Wyndham Clarks are starting to emerge. The Nick Taylors are emerging, and they're playing very well. They're playing very, very well every single week. And there's some other great stories. But, you know, to get some of those fringe viewers back, these show ponies, they need to be up there. They need to be shown it a little bit more and taking advantage of what they all voted in, and that's no cut. Basically 70 players, no cut, and you know, they're not taking advantage of that.
John, just a couple more before I let you go. And I think you are by far one of the best golf analysts that we've ever had in this business. You've been doing a great job for several years, and you're one of my favorite voices to listen to. I think the same of Gary Koch and Roger Maltby. It feels like the networks are out there searching for who the next guy should be in the booth. And I'm saying to myself and anybody who will listen, we've had three of the best for decades now in the booth. Why are we looking for somebody else to come in there and be on the mic? It's just my opinion, but I don't think there's any young viewer that is sitting back saying to themselves, I'm not going to watch golf because the guys that are on the mic here, those guys are old, and I want a younger voice. I don't think that's a decision that anybody is making, whether to turn a golf tournament on or off. I hate the fact that we are trying to get rid of three guys that have just been the best there is. Just your thoughts.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Chris. And you're right. Gary Koch and Roger Maltby are, you know, two icons in the broadcast business. And I think, you know, a lot has to do with, you know, the reps that they did, the training, just being there, learning, you know, watching, observing. But I think too, and this is what I try to do, and this is, you know, where I've learned a lot, is, you know, we're thinking out loud as players. Roger Maltby won 5 times on the PGA Tour. Gary Koch won, I think, the same, maybe more. I won, you know, double digits on the PGA Tour. And you know, we have the passion for what we're doing, and that's basically calling the golf shot as we see it or as we felt it under those same circumstances and those situations. I don't know. I wish I had the answer on why Gary and Roger were moved along. I know it had a little bit to do with an age thing, but then they hired my great friend Kurt Byram, who's 64, and Brad Faxon, who's in his 60s as well. So yeah, that's kind of a lame excuse. I know they're trying to develop some of the younger guys. I think Smiley Coffin does a really, really nice job, but he won 1 time on the PGA Tour, and that's, you know, shooting 61 on a Sunday, and that's no, it's not easy. And Smiley is a wonderful, wonderful young man with a great sense of humor. He seems that he's really learning a lot. And then you have, and I have great respect for, you know, the caddies on tour. I some of my best friends, but they can only show you so much and tell you so much. They cannot tell you how a player is actually feeling on a Sunday afternoon near the lead. He can tell you what they're thinking about, but they're not hitting the golf shot. And you know, to have, you know, maybe Kevin Kisner, you know, he's been there and done that a lot, but it just seems like they're just trying to find, you know, that seat to replace Johnny Miller and then, you know, the great Paul Azinger. And I think that they, you know, kind of bypassed some names or let go of some names that, could do it for a long time, still have the passion, still have the energy to do it. And like I said, still have the passion to talk about, you know, golf, being played on a Friday afternoon, trying to make a cut, or a Sunday, trying to chase down a championship. There's a number of guys out there that have done it a lot. I can tell you how to win, Chris, and I can tell you how to lose. I did a lot of it both. and you know, I think the viewer likes to hear that.
Yes.
You know, not just fun and games. And I know these guys are such great friends with all the young guys. Hey, I get that. But when it comes down to Sunday, I want to listen to Ken Venturi. I want to listen to Tom Weisskopf. I want to listen to Nick Faldo. I want to listen to Johnny Miller, Paul Azinger. These guys have won. They're Hall of Famers, and they've won a lot of golf tournaments. I would rather listen to them than some comedy show coming down the stretch on a Sunday when, you know, everything's on the line, and your mouth is so dry that you can't spit, You can hardly take a glass of water. I mean, your brain is outrunning your body. I mean, I want to know that. I felt that. And I loved hearing it from, you know, those great voices.
100%. Couldn't agree with anything more than what you just said. That's what I want to listen to. And I got to believe that's what everybody that's tuning into a golf tournament wants to listen to. I've been kind of beside myself with what we're doing here.
Yeah, Chris, they want to learn, and I want to teach them. I want them to understand, you know, what I went through. Like I said, I won a bunch and I lost a bunch. I can tell you how to do both of them. And I think the viewers want to hear that. And
yes,
like Lanny Watkins, he said a long time ago to me, he says, don't be afraid to first guess. It's easy to be that Monday morning quarterback or say, oh, that's not the shot he should have played. Well, you should have already set the shot up on what you would do. It may not be the same thing that that player is doing, but at least you gave a call and you went out on a limb to see what type of shot needs to be played here. So that's what I want to know.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's what everybody tuned in wants to know. And that's what we want to hear. I hate the fact that we're fooling around with this thing when we've got such great talent that have been on the mics. Why are we trying to go a different direction when these guys want to be there? They know what they're talking about. They've been great voices for decades. You guys should be the ones that are on there. I wish the broadcast world would leave it alone.
Yeah, I agree with you. It'd be fun to do. I would welcome it.
Cookie, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can they stay up to date with all the great things you're doing, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I'm on Twitter, X, I'm John Cook Golf. And on Instagram, I'm JNCOOKOSU on Instagram. I'm not on Facebook, but we do a lot of that. We talk golf. We have some fun, poke at each other. So that's where you can find me.
Well, Cookie, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show. You're one of my absolute all-time favorites. I really enjoy every time you come back and you're a part of the show. I love the stories you tell. And I always learn something along the way. So thank you very much for that.
I appreciate it, Chris. Anytime. I love doing the show.
Appreciate you. Take care, John. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Sounds good.
See you, John. That is the great John Cook, folks. Again, at JN Cook OSU for Ohio State University, if you're not aware. On Instagram and at John Cook Golf. You can find him on Twitter or X or whatever we're calling that thing these days. But a more knowledgeable, nicer guy you will not find. And the thing, like we said there at the end, or at least that, you know, I wanted to get the point across. Cookie's just fantastic. I know you've all heard him call a tour, you know, whether a PGA Tour event or a Champions Tour event. You know how knowledgeable he is. You know how honest and frank he is. You get a sense of what's going on out there in the player's mind and in that golf tournament when you've got John on the mic. The same can be said for those other guys. I mean, for crying out loud, Gary Koch is just been doing a great job for decades. So is Roger Maltby. Those are the voices we want to hear to exactly what John said. When things are coming down the stretch, you want to know what's going through that player's mind. You want to know their experiences, whether, like John said, winning a golf tournament or hitting a shot that cost you a golf tournament. You want to hear about all of that and how that pertains to what's going on with what we're watching on the screen. I wish these broadcast executives would get it right and get off of changing guys. And it feels like we're doing on the job, you know, training or on the job interviews week after week, different guys cycling through. No, put John Cook in there, put Gary Koch in there, put Roger Maltby in there, and let's let a golf tournament be what we want it to be. Whether we're watching it or we're listening to it on the radio, we want the best that have ever done it to be out there doing it. And those are three of the guys that should be there, in my opinion. Very much appreciate John's time. Look forward to having him back on the show again, hopefully a little bit later on in the season. All right, my friends, that's going to wrap up part one of this week's show. My sincere thanks to Tom Patry and John Cook for being a part of it and for you for tuning in and listening and being a part of Next on the Tee Nation. You guys are outstanding. I hope you'll come back for part two, which is going to feature Mark Calcavecchia, who is actually over in Augusta right now. A lot of great stories coming up from Mark, from being on property, from his experiences playing there. I've got a bunch of fantastic stories from Mark, and including the fact that it was he and Ken Green who started the idea of skipping the ball across the pond on 16 during the practice round. You're going to want to hear that story. And following him is going to be my Goomba, Rob Strano, one of the best people on the planet and a fantastic instructor on top of that. So I hope you'll come back and check out part two of this week's show. In between now and then, hit him straight, my friends.